Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast.
This is Jerry Bain, podcasting from the EDUCAUSE 2013 Security Conference in St. Louis, and I'm joined in conversation today with Randy Marchini, University IT Security Officer for Virginia Tech. Thanks for joining us today, Randy. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Well, let's talk about something you're talking about here at the conference. It's called the 20 critical controls that have been developed by cybersecurity experts. First of all, can you talk a little bit about the development of the list and how you found it, and maybe the pick five critical controls out of that list that have been effective for you?
Sure. The 20 critical controls is basically a document that was developed by a number of institutions, cybersecurity institutions, and basically the idea was to come up with a subset of things that different actions that security types could undertake to give them quick wins. Something that's effective, something that's relatively cheap, something that doesn't really require a lot of vendor products or stuff like that. But the idea was to you have to start somewhere. There's thousands of these, you know, actions that could be done. Let's start with these 20. And then the idea was to take the 20, do those 20, and then move on to more things as time permits. Mm-hmm. They're based off of the ISO 27002 standards. They're based off of the NIST 800-53 standards, and I believe the Australian CERT standards that are in there, they're also included in that. And so the 20 controls, for instance, are a subset of the priority one items that are listed in the NIST 800-53. There's a mapping to the 27002 areas, control areas, that you can get in various documents. So it was designed basically to give you a way to focus on assurance rather than compliance, mm-hmm. rather than just checklisting off of this. It actually was something that would give you meaningful data.
So could you tell us about a few?
One of the first controls is something that almost everybody can use. They call it the inventory of authorized and unauthorized devices. Basically what that means is you want to reduce the ability of an attacker to plug into your network and bypass any network access control or any registration type stuff on there. So you want to be able to have some sort of active monitoring capability to detect that, ooh, a new device just got on my wired network, or there's a new wireless device or something like that. It turns out that most network management groups and campuses have tools that can give you that type of information. Mm-hmm. They might use it for diagnostic purposes. You know, I can't get on the net. Oh, what's your portal? What's your IP address? What's your host name? And then they use that information to zero in on the particular port or whatever. So they have that for diagnostic purposes, and you can take that same tool and use it for incident response, which is what we do in the security office at Tech. But now I can take that same information and I can say, well, now I have an inventory of devices that are registered to be on the net.
Mm-hmm. So for a layman, do hackers tend to use different devices than what is normally accepted?
They try to use as many devices as they possibly can. And, yeah, if they're able to tap into the network by either impersonating you or just taking advantage of an open port, they will use that because they'll move off. They'll disconnect from the net as soon as they launch their attack.
Gotcha.
So that's one of them there. Another one of the top controls that we look at is called developing secure configurations for hardware and software for laptops or workstations or desktops. Mm-hmm. I know you can't see it in the podcast, but I'm just kind of holding my arm up, and we call this the "you must be this tall to play on our network"
right.
type thing, kind of what you see at Disney. Uh-huh. But it's setting a minimum security standard for laptops, workstations, and desktops, and servers on campus, you know, patches, host-based firewall turned on. The most important one, which is actually a hard one to do, is who's the person responsible for that machine? Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's hard to find out who it is. Well, I think it's the IT guy, and the IT goes, no, it's the faculty member, or it's the student,
right.
or who owns
right.
it. You know, making sure that your application's software is patched up and up to date. Making sure you have strong passwords for each of the user IDs on those machines. So that's one of the ones that's another one that we've got. At Virginia Tech, we have a policy and a standard that mandates those items have to be present on any technology device. And the way the policy was worded, that also includes smartphones and things like that, mm-hmm. because it's a technology sure. device, connects to our network. So that in that case, that policy and standard kind of, you know, broaden it out for all the classes of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's another one of the other controls that we use. Mm-hmm. The security office, one of our things that we do is we have a list of critical servers, the database servers and things like that. And if you're in a department, say statistics, and you say, this server here is a critical to the statistics mm-hmm. department, I'd like you to scan it on a regular basis for vulnerabilities. We do that. We run vulnerability scans. We use Rapid7 by Nexpose as a commercial tool, the quasi-commercial tool we use Nessus. And every week we will run a vulnerability scan against that list of servers. And then if there's a problem, we'll let the admins know, hey, we found this, or if, you know, is it a false positive or whatever. That actually is one of the controls, because basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to find any vulnerabilities before the hackers do mm-hmm. and go from there.
Well, before we get to talking about Virginia Tech in general, could you talk about how people can find these 20 critical controls? Are they freely available?
Yeah, they're freely available. If you just go out and Google for the 20 critical controls, you'll find the website that's got it. It's hosted right now. It's hosted at the SANS Institute's website. It's www.sans.org/ and then critical-security-controls.
Great.
And so you can download the document. It's a PDF. It's a freebie. It gives you each control broken down in quick wins, attribution. And in some cases, they actually give you maybe a list of some vendor products that can help you with that particular control.
Okay. And we'll put that in the show notes as well, that link.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about what Virginia Tech's overall security strategy is and how these controls figure into that thinking?
Basically, again, we're trying to base our IT security strategy on ISO 27002 and the NIST 853s. The real driving premise of the strategy is protect sensitive data wherever it's located. In our world, sensitive data is defined by we call it PII, personally identifiable information, and it's social security number, credit card number, driver's license number, passport number, or bank or debit account information. What we determine, at least in Virginia, is that if anybody has those items with your name, they can steal your identity. They
right.
can get a credit card, open up a bank account. So the standard basically is that if you have a file that has any of those elements in it, it has to be encrypted at rest or in transit. I don't care where it's stored. It
right.
can be on a smartphone. It can be on a laptop. It can be in a database on a server. So that is the overall strategy point there. The other part of the strategy is to make security as local as possible. Say you're the IT guy for mechanical engineering. I want to be able to take the enterprise-wide tools that we've got in the security office, and I want to be able to create a local view for the mechanical engineering addresses, and then maybe set up like an account for you to log into those devices and see, you know, what the vulnerability reports are for it or that. So you've got your own local view of things. Because when it comes right down to it, you know, I'm my office is on campus. You're on the other side of campus. I have no idea who the troublemakers are in your department, but you do. So part of the security strategy is to make as many of these tools that are enterprise-wide viewable at the local level for you.
That's great.
And then, you know, basically, in a sense, we're not so much worried about what comes into the net because we're a university. It could come from anywhere. But that sensitive data piece that we're talking about, that's what we're looking for if we see anything that has sensitive data going out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the strategy
that we're looking at.
That
makes a lot of sense. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you approach the balance and relationship between security and privacy?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah. The problem is there's always going to be a trade-off between security
right.
and privacy. As an example, when we're talking about one of the controls of this inventory of devices, that means that you have to know where those devices are. If it's a smartphone or a wireless a laptop, can I tell you what building you're in? Can I tell you, you know, what room you're in? Do I have that technology to be able to say that? It turns out with smartphones, That's there already. I think it was the Wall Street Journal did a talk on your apps are watching you. And it talks about the amount of information that apps for smartphones like Angry Birds or ESPN or whatever, how much of that information it sends out to either the developers or an ad network, location, where you were when you opened up the app, how long you had that. So in a sense, the privacy's gone already, and we just didn't read the fine print, you know, Facebook. You know, with where you are, Foursquare and things like that, you know, which, where are you doing? Well, now your smartphone knows where you are. And then, you know, it's like on the iPhones, what's the nearest coffee shop? Well, it has to know where you are first to let you know what's close by.
Right.
And so in that sense, we've given up a certain amount of privacy already. The question is, and students usually say this to me is, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so it doesn't matter to me. And I said, that's not the point. It's, you know, doing something wrong, of course you want to, you know, we want to be able to find you. But if I look at the body of work, that every day I see that at 8:45 you leave your house and you walk down the street and you stop somewhere between 9 o'clock and 9:15 at the Starbucks that's a couple blocks from your apartment, and then, you know, half an hour later, you're going by a sports store and blah, 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 and all this type of stuff, I can figure out that, oh, there's a special at the sports store, and so I'll send you information on that.
Right.
So it's that big data mining marketing thing that really is where the value of that data is.
Yeah.
So in a way, I don't mind if you collect that data about me if you tell me up front. But if you collect it and you don't tell me, that bothers me. And so and that's just the way I, you know, would I say no? Probably not. Yeah, fine. You want to know where I am?
Right.
That's okay. But at least I know.
That you know.
That you know.
Right.
As opposed to the other way around. And, you know, and Facebook, they changed their policies. They changed
their
policies.
They do it about every 3 months.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a little three-year-old kid, you know, where the kid, you tell them, don't touch the stove. And then they go up and they touch the stove and they want to see what your reaction is.
Right.
And if you don't react, well, then they're going to keep touching the stove. And so Facebook, you know, does something. What was it, a couple years ago when they said, oh, any pictures you upload to Facebook become our property?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that type of thing. And then they wait to see, and then if there's a lot of uproar about it,
they
back off.
Right.
But then they come back a year later with the same thing to see if anything's changed. So that's kind of where we are with the privacy and the security piece right now.
Right. Do hackers have anything to do with that? Do they use that material ever?
They absolutely can. And in fact, where it really comes in is with what we call phishing, where I'm sending you a specific email. You know, Jerry, you're doing podcasts for you know, EDUCAUSE. I might send you some information about a new podcast tool that, and you look at it and go, well, you know, this one I'm using, yeah, let's see what's out on the market. And you click on a link and boom, you're infected.
Right.
You know, for me, I play volleyball. Well, you know, here's the latest on volleyball clinics or coaching clinics or stuff like that.
Right.
So they'll use that information to try and find something that they know you're interested in, that in, you know, you just go, oh, yeah, okay.
Right.
You know, I played in a volleyball tournament. I must have signed something and they got my name on the mailing list.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't covered?
Well, I think the 20 critical controls is a great place to start.
Cool.
You don't have to do them all in one shot. You need to remember that it's a long-term project. For us, I'm guessing it's going to be a 3 to 5 year project. And after we've just finished, you know, the first 9 months of it, I'm thinking it might be a 5 to 7 year project.
Right.
But it's something to do long-term, and you pick the ones that you can do first.
Great.
We all have this information. It's just trying to find out who has it in the university.
Right.
And I think that if you start chipping away at that, that ultimately you're going to come up with a stronger security posture for the university. Because the one thing you don't want to do is interfere, you know, you have that balance. I need to not interfere with the business process or people will get around it. I think it's a good place to start.
Well, great. Thanks so much for your time, Randy.
Sure, no problem.
Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.